night's game and some of the prices and everything. I get all of that. But there's gotten to be electricity around the city. I mean, just seeing Spike Lee's on the what was on the set before. They're showing replays of Inside the NBA with some of the guys. And I think tonight's going to be an absolute spectacle. New York, the Knicks with a chance to go up 3-0 and essentially put one hand on the trophy, the Larry O'Brien. I mean, I think tonight is going to be an absolute movie in New York, and it's going to be fun to watch. And the atmosphere, I can only imagine being just absolutely insane. And for me, we were talking about this last week, Danny and I. Going to a game at the Garden, a Knicks game at the Garden, is on my bucket list. And I can only imagine an NBA Finals game. Because I've been to an NBA Finals game. I've been to two of them. I got lucky enough to cover them when I was in Milwaukee. In 2021, Game 3 was incredible. The atmosphere was great. But I don't know, unless I cover a Super Bowl, I guess if I would go to a World Cup game while it's here in the U.S., especially the big-time games, whether it's like a quarterfinal or semifinal or the final or something of that nature, I don't know that there will be anything that tops the atmosphere that I experienced back in July of 2021 at Pfizer Forum in Milwaukee. And if you remember during that time frame, coming off of COVID and all that stuff, and restrictions were lifted, and so people were starting to get out and really enjoy the freedom again of being able to hang out in crowds and everything of that nature. To see the amount of people that were outside the arena, I could post the pictures, or you could go back and find them on my Twitter, of the thousands and thousands and thousands of people that were outside the arena, thronged together to watch Game 6 of the Bucks and the Suns. And Giannis dropping 50. They were probably, the stands weren't fully opened up yet for that one. I would say there were probably maybe 15,000 in the crowd, maybe a little bit less in the crowd that night at Pfizer. It's still one of the loudest, if not the loudest, I've ever heard an arena when they were closing it out. Didn't help that I was sitting right by the drum line up in the rafters of the stadium in the auxiliary press box of sorts. But that was incredible. And then there were 60-some thousand outside in the couple of blocks around the stadium. So when everything is going right for a city, and especially teams that the Bucks hadn't won in 50 years, and so to be able to recapture some of that magic for them was absolutely incredible to be a part of. New York, being what New York is and what the Knicks are to that city and what Madison Square Garden is to that city, I can only imagine how insane it's going to be tonight at MSG. Game 4 in a couple of nights, how crazy that's going to be, especially if they have a chance to close it out. I mean, Game 4 tickets, if the Knicks win tonight, I can't even imagine how expensive those are going to get. A chance to close it out on the Garden floor in a sweep, in which they've been on their winning streak, what is it, 14 games now? A chance for them to maybe finish it out or something of that nature? Absolutely insane. But thinking specifically on the matchup tonight for the Knicks and the Spurs, if you want to hop in, feel free, 800-636-1067, getting ready for Game 3 of the NBA Finals. Tip off in about 25 minutes or so. That Finals that I referenced, Bucks and Suns, that was a 2-0 series lead for the Suns before the Bucks won four straight. So you can't rule the Spurs out. Now, the difference was the Suns won both on their home floor to start the series. Then the Bucks came home 1-2, went back to Phoenix 1-1, and then came back to Milwaukee and closed it out in six on their home floor. I don't know that San Antonio is coming back from this series after dropping the first two at home. I mean, it's really, really tough. What do they always talk about when you talk about the first pair of games on each other's home floors? You just want to find a way to split the pair. I don't think that you can sit here as San Antonio and think, yeah, we'll split the pair. You gotta win both games at the Garden. You really want to be down 3-1? I know We've seen a 3-1 comeback before. They also had LeBron. The Spurs don't have LeBron. As good as Wemby is right now, he ain't LeBron in 2016. He doesn't have that ability. He doesn't have that much pull compared to what LeBron did to do what he did to come back against that Warriors team. And I just think watching those first two games of this series has been fun to watch to see the way that the Spurs have been able to get things going and then the way that the Knicks can close games. I just don't see a way in which the Spurs win this series unless all of their young guys grow up in an absolute hurry. And I mean, the last couple of days, they better have matured 10 years of NBA experience. Because I think what you saw from the Knicks in these first two games was an experience of playing in the league long enough that they don't panic in these big situations. And there's a togetherness that you haven't necessarily seen from the Spurs. And it's funny because the Spurs had big series wins. To see them beat the defending champs in Oklahoma City and the physicality that was a part of that series and the experience, the championship pedigree that OKC had, for them to beat them and then face this New York Knicks team that doesn't have a championship pedigree, yes, has experience as NBA players, but not even great playoff experience overall. It's wild to see how they've crumbled because they didn't crumble against OKC. You know, maybe it's a little different with Jalen Williams on the floor, but even so, you're still going against the back-to-back MVP, and he didn't shrivel. And it's not like the Spurs guys, they didn't shrivel in the big moments in the Western Conference Finals, but it feels like too often in this series, they have come up a little bit short. I mean, that play at the end of the game with Wemby and Castle, I don't know who you want to pin the blame on there, but man, is that tough. And does that reek of inexperience and a little bit of insecurity or just not fully into lack of confidence, I guess, is the best way to say it. Because either Wemby's got to bring that ball up the floor and just own it, and it's mine, or Stephon Castle's got to own it. Someone's got to own that moment. I also think that Mitch Johnson has been majorly outcoached in this series by Mike Brown. I'd love to see Mike Brown win this series. Was a big fan of him back in his days in Cleveland. And to see the evolution of his career bouncing around and now with New York, I'd love to see him get a ring in this series. But I think Mitch Johnson has looked majorly outmatched in this series for the Spurs, and it hasn't helped them. Because too often on offense for San Antonio in this series, they come down the floor, and they have no plan. No plan. And game one, I thought too often they were just giving the ball to Wemby at the top of the key and saying, figure it out. As good as Wemby is, he doesn't have so tight of a handle that you can't get a hand in the cookie jar as a help defender on the wing. And so he's going to turn the ball over. He's also not a sudden athlete, being as big as he is. And it's not necessarily criticisms, it's just observations of a guy that is his size. He's such a unique player. There's not many of his like in NBA history, if there are any at all. So I just don't think that it's in their best interest to give him the ball at the top of the key and let him operate against Karl Anthony Towns. It's a little bit different if you can get him the ball on a kickout. You saw this in game two, get him on a kickout. Mitchell Robinson having to try to get outside. He does not as fleet of foot as a cat, not as agile. And you just see Victor Wembanyama kind of blow by and get a floater of sorts. I think if they can get in those situations, it's a little bit different. But the Knicks have had an answer for everything that the Spurs are trying to do offensively for the most part. And I think you're going to have to see some other guys really step up. And the big part, I think, for New York, Jalen Brunson has not had a good game yet this series. He just hasn't. His fourth quarter in game one was really, really good. But overall, he was very inefficient. And then game two, there were times where it almost looked like they were better off when the ball wasn't in his hands. And so I'm curious to see if Mike Brown finds another way to get him involved, where he doesn't have to go one-on-one or try to drive against some of the defenders that San Antonio is able to throw at him, because that is one thing that San Antonio has a plethora of, is good perimeter defenders, whether it's Castle, who's spectacular as a defender out on the perimeter. You know, Champagne's pretty solid out there. De'Aaron Fox. They've got guys. But you've got to feel good if you're the Knicks, thinking we're coming back home, two games on our home floor, to take a 3-1 lead if we just win one of them. And we haven't had a Brunson game yet. I know he's scored a lot of points, but it's taken a lot of shots. If Brunson tonight scores 30 points on 18 shots, that might be curtains for this series. I mean, because of the fact that at least San Antonio has made him work. If he's going and Kat's going, I still don't know what the plan is on offense for San Antonio, which is a little scary through two games to not have an idea of what exactly they're trying to do on offense. You know, their plan can't be just everybody hitting great shots. And it's a credit to what the Knicks are doing defensively. Maybe an extra day allows them to be a little bit fresher, because I do think that you've seen them be a little bit more tired and worn down than what you saw the Knicks being. And it's understandable. You went to seven games versus a team that swept. But I think tonight's game is going to be an absolute blast to watch. The atmosphere at MSG is going to be electric. And I actually think that that does favor New York a lot, because when you look at what has happened in the first couple of games in the series, it feels like San Antonio, when the moments have gotten bigger, have shrunk a little bit, and that's when the New York Knicks are at their most comfortable, and that grittiness and having a guy like Jalen Brunson has really come through for them. I think tonight, with the atmosphere being as raucous as it is at MSG, I almost wonder if it amps up some of those guys on San Antonio's side a little bit too much. Not to say that OKC isn't a great atmosphere, because OKC, they get very raucous, they're incredibly loud, but there's something to play in the Garden, especially in the NBA Finals. So tonight's a massive one, and frankly, if the Spurs want to win, Victor Wembanyama has to really step up. Wemby's got to have a much better game than what we saw in the first couple, be more efficient, be impactful defensively, but I also think that Mitch Johnson needs to get things going as well. 800-636-1067 if you'd like to hop in. NBA Finals getting ready to tip off in about 15 minutes, and we're talking about it on The Fan. Game 3 of the NBA Finals is going to tip off in about 10 minutes or so at Madison Square Garden in New York. 800-636-1067 if you'd like to hop in. Just a couple of minutes, about 10 minutes, we'll be joined by Joe Spadoni of 95.7 The Game, Morning Roast. I want to talk about Brandon Ayuk. We'll talk a little bit of Nats and Giants as well, but Spadoni does a great job with their morning show out in San Francisco, so we'll talk to him coming up in about 10 minutes. But final couple of thoughts before we get Game 3 tipped off here with the Knicks and the Spurs. I thought it was interesting hearing the Inside the NBA guys talking about some of the things that they saw Game 2 of the series. Feels like Victor Wembanyama and the Spurs in general need to play with a little bit more urgency and desperation. They played with a little bit of it, but Victor in particular at times was not playing with that urgency and desperation that you'd like to see from the superstar of the team going into a... There are no such thing as must-win games, in my opinion, until you get to the true elimination games. But Game 2 on your home floor as the favorite in the series is as close to a must-win game as it gets. And he didn't always play with that desperation. And one thing that I think is funny, he's a very emotional guy, and that's fine. I like seeing that emotion. I like seeing him care. I like seeing what I saw, you know, after they won the Western Conference Finals. But Kevin Garnett got blasted on the internet for saying, hey, you got four more, man. That ain't it. No one cares that you got to the finals. That's awesome. That's great. That's a lot of fun. You got to go win that thing now. You got four more games to win. You can't be losing all your energy in a celebration because you won game seven against the defending champs in the Western Conference Finals. And I think there is something to that. It's like they almost had put so much into winning that series, which you should. You got to put everything in. But when they finally won it, the emotion was almost of that they had won the NBA Finals. And they haven't. And I don't know if it was something where, hey, we're going to celebrate as much as possible and then we'll move on the next day. But I don't know. It almost felt like they were looking past whoever they were going to have to face in the NBA Finals because, all right, we're facing the defending champs in the Western Conference Finals. It's just tough. And my original prediction was Spurs in seven. And I just got to be honest, I don't see a way that the Spurs win this series at all now. Obviously down 2-0. I don't know that this series goes more than five. And, you know, if you win and you're the Knicks, you'd like to win on your home floor. So maybe they have to win it in, you know, a sweep or win it in six. But I just don't see a way in which the Spurs can recover from the way that they were playing early in this series. Being able to slow down Jalen Brunson and still not walking away with a win in either of them, I think that's going to hurt them. Because now back on the MSG floor, I think that Jalen Brunson and Mike Brown, they're going to find some way to get him some better looks, whether he has to play off the ball a little bit more. But they also just don't shrivel. And so anytime that they're going to be in a close game, the Spurs have tightened up a little bit late in these games. The Knicks, that's when they play their most free, it feels like. And so if you are the Knicks, you basically have bought yourself a buffer there where we just got to be within 10 points or so with 5 minutes to go, and we feel like we've got a chance. So for them, it's just about trying to keep things close for the entire game. If they blow them out, great. But if you don't, you ain't worried about coming back. You feel more comfortable in the environment just because of the experience of the guys. The youth of San Antonio has really shown up. And again, I think this raucous atmosphere, we'll see early on. That's another thing that the Knicks have done a really good job of. Part of the reason that the Spurs were able to beat OKC, they would come out with a really big haymaker early on, especially those last couple of games of the series. And they haven't necessarily been able to do that against this Knicks team. So that's something that I'm very interested to see how it plays out tonight. I kind of think the Knicks win in five. I mean, it's just, I would love for this to be a more competitive series. I think the NBA would love this to be a chance for Victor Wembanyama kind of use this as a springboard into becoming the face of the league. I just don't know that it's going to happen with the way that the Spurs are playing. And that's something that so many times, this is how I felt about the Commanders in 2024 before they ended up getting ousted in the NFC Championship game. We can talk about who the better team is and this and that and go roster for roster and look at who the better player is and, you know, almost Madden style, look at the team overall. What matters is how well you're playing. I don't really care if that other team is better than you. If you're just playing so together and you're not shooting yourself in the foot and you're playing just at a really, really high level, you can beat anybody. And I think that's where the New York Knicks are right now, just playing at an extremely high level. Not to say that they're not talented, but I would think that San Antonio is the more talented team just looking at it on paper. But the way that the Knicks are playing, I don't expect them to suddenly fall off a cliff. San Antonio is going to have to beat them. And I haven't seen enough through two games to think that they're going to win both these games at MSG. And if that's the case, I don't see them coming back into the series unless they win both games at MSG. And that's not happening. That's not going to happen. So game three, going to tip off here in just a couple of minutes. We'll keep you up to date on the score of that one throughout the evening, taking you up until Nats baseball. Next, Joe Spadoni of the Morning Roast, 95.7 The Game, out in San Francisco. He's going to join us. Want to get his thoughts on the Aiyuk situation from the other side. How much blame does San Fran get, like we talked about earlier? Want to get his thoughts on that. Also give you a quick thoughts on Nats and Giants ahead of their three-game series starting tonight out in San Fran. You're listening to Overtime on 106.7 The Fan. Welcome back. Overtime, 106.7 The Fan. Toby Altizer taking you up until Nats baseball. They're out on the West Coast taking on the San Francisco Giants. And we'll talk a little Giants and Nats before we get done with our guest on the Rude Guest Hotline. Rude, the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV, Joe Spadoni from 95.7 The Game Morning Roast out there in San Francisco. Joe, we got to start, though, with Brandon Ayuk. I feel like I was talking about this earlier. Nationally, they talk about it a little bit, but I feel like they've kind of moved on. And then us in D.C. and you guys out in San Francisco, we got to talk about this crap every day.
Yeah, and thanks for having me on, Toby. This guy, I guess, is the gift that keeps on giving for us sports talk radio guys. But, I mean, I'm sure you guys have played the soundbite all day. You've cut it up. I'm sure that the slow-mo, whoever's idea was it with this rant to do the little slow-mo, you know, female dog, the cat fit, like, just bravo, whoever thought of it, and Ayuk's team, if it was Ayuk himself. But, yeah, it's giving Antonio Brown Hard Knocks Raiders vibes.
Yeah.
But I don't want to bestow him on that because we all know with Antonio Brown, that's no one wants that comparison just yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's so crazy, Joe. And to see how things have gotten here, I mean, did you expect it to get to this point? I mean, it felt like early in his career, he wasn't a massive issue. And then obviously there was some problems with the relationship and to get where we've gotten. Did you ever think it would get to this point?
To this point, no. Were there some signs that the relationship was odd kind of from the beginning between Kyle Shanahan and Ayuk? A little bit. Just going back to when he was a rookie, you know, being in the doghouse, quote unquote, that was the term that was used when he kind of fell out of favor to guys like Trent Sherfield, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, he worked back into the good graces of Kyle Shanahan. He produced really well, second team all pro. Then, you know, he ends up losing the Super Bowl at Allegiant Stadium to the Chiefs. Him and his girlfriend have this weird post about, like, not wanting to come back to the Niners. It was very odd and strange. And it was very, you know, on brand for the time with a lot of his teammates trying to get new contracts, Debo Samuel, the holdouts, trade me. So I say all that to say, I didn't think it would get to this level, but to say it's been a smooth ride all the way through his career thus far, I'd be lying to you. There's been a lot of bumps.
Interesting. I didn't know about some of those bumps along the way. It's funny because obviously out here we spent plenty of time, whether you want him or not, and talking about the videos and the different stuff about, you know, Ayuk's situation. I'm curious, as someone that is more plugged in with the Niners, how much blame do you think is on their side? Is it something where, hey, they signed this guy, he should show up to work, and, you know, he's the malcontent, and and the ball's in his court? Or do you think that they deserve a little bit of blame the way that they tend to play a little more hardball with some of their players, and it clearly didn't work in this scenario with Brandon Ayuk?
Well, it's a good question. We were talking about that on the show this morning, like the blame game, right? Like, and, you know, I feel zero sorriness for either party in this because they should have known each other when they signed that big contract. They had 3+ years together. You know, you've had him since he was a rookie. You should have known who this guy was when you gave him the contract, or at least somewhat. Now, people change after major injuries, and he had a major injury a couple seasons ago. He totally, you know, shred his knee, and he might never get back on the field or be the player he once was. And, you know, sometimes it takes a player to kind of reconcile with that fact to get back onto, you know, the path of getting back into playing. Because I look at a guy like Klay Thompson, it's not like for like the same comparison, but I remember Klay, obviously multi-time champion, he had 2 devastating injuries. You know, he tore his ACL in the finals, and then, you know, coming back a year later, he tore his Achilles, and that was brutal. And Klay changed, his personality changed in a big, big way from that happy-go-lucky, you know, nothing bothers me, to kind of sensitive and, you know, easily annoyed, and he felt the pressure from the fan base. And, you know, I'm not saying it's like for like the same thing, but people change after injury. We've seen that in sports. So something clearly changed with him, and it's gotten weird. And I don't know if we'll ever find out what exactly happened between whether it was Shanahan, Lynch, you know, Ayuk. I have no idea. But to say that the 49ers are totally, you know, without blame here, I just don't buy that, considering you gave him all this money. You should have known somewhat that it could be combustible, because there was patterns leading up to it.
Talking with Joe Spadoni from the Morning Roast out in San Francisco, 95.7 The Game. Speaking on Ayuk, the football player, I mean, we haven't seen this guy play in almost 2 calendar years by the time the season kicks off. Do we know what kind of shape he is in or if he can play. I mean, I've seen videos of him running routes pregame at some point last year. Like, was there ever a chance that he was actually going to play last year? And do we even have any idea of if he's healthy enough to play football?
Your guess is as good as mine from all the beat reporters. Like, hell, I was at joint practices last year between the Broncos when they were in town and the Niners over at Levi Stadium. And I saw Ayuk in sweats. He was hanging out. Looked like he was in shape. Again, he was all in sweats and, you know, it was 100 degrees and he was still rocked out in, you know, triple layers. But he looked like he was champing at the bit, you know, to play. He was talking up with a lot of the young wide receivers, Ricky Pearsall, you know, Juwan Jennings, and it looked like he was being a leader out there. So it came to a shock and surprise, you know, halfway through the season when all the stuff started getting leaked out about, you know, guaranteed contracts getting voided, he hasn't shown up, all very, very strange. As far as the shape he goes, my producer got in my ear when we were playing the soundbite earlier today from Instagram. He's like, hey, at least Ayuk looks like he got a little skinnier in this video. I was like, how do you know? Like, how do you know? Like, no one knows where this guy is. I mean, if he's not speeding in a car and getting a misdemeanor over by Levi Stadium, he's recording these weird videos. So I say all that to say, Toby, I have no idea. It could be the James Harden effect. One day he looks big, the other day he looks skinny. Who knows?
I mean, what is the vibe out there? Because out here, I mean, it's so controversial. Some people are, you know, oh, it's all the Niners' fault and the way they treat players. Why wouldn't you sign this guy? And then on the flip side, you've got people saying this is a buffoon and I don't want him anywhere near the facility. What is it on the flip side for you guys? Are you just over it?
Well, we've done a good job, at least on our show anyways, of kind of like not diving too much into like the drama aspect. Now, when you have a video like that, you kind of have to talk about it. And a lot of the conversation's been, you know, first and foremost, like, hey, is this guy okay mentally? Because Whenever someone kind of does something out of left field, and it's a good thing in today's society where we're more open about mental health and talking about and discussing it. But, you know, I don't want to use the word CTE because that's extreme. I'm not throwing that, you know, towards him or anything like that. But, you know, fans get concerned and radio hosts definitely get concerned. And you want to kind of tiptoe around that. That being said, you know, when you just start dissecting it and it's the blame game, it does get old in the sense of, who knows? Until one of those guys says exactly what was the tipping point, we're just going to be, you know, talking like we are right now and saying, what the hell happened? And, you know, until Brandon Ayuk goes on a podcast for someone years from now, maybe we'll never know.
Maybe he can go on the Debo Samuel podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Debo says like two words a minute. Whoever that host is with Debo, God bless her, because she says everything and Debo chimes in two words. We were replaying some of the stuff he said a couple of years ago when he did sign the contract. And Ayuk's like, yeah, you know, it's great to, you know, stay here, hang out with friends and family. He just, even when he signed the contract, he just sounded like a guy that just wasn't very happy. And I might be reading too much into that. I have no idea. Some of these guys, him, Debo, they're very aloof too. And maybe that's just the next generation. I don't know.
Well, and I think that's interesting because Adam Peters obviously comes from San Francisco working with John Lynch. And we saw some of those same tactics with Terry McLaurin and that contract negotiation. And it's kind of soured some of the fan base on Terry McLaurin. Some of that's come back now with him being a part of it. But do you see them changing any of their negotiation tactics or anything of that nature going forward with some of the stuff that's happened? But I mean, you know, you can't fault them for moving off Debo after the year that he had. And I know there was some frustration, but it's also a little bit of a curse of the Niners having so many good players that they got to try to penny pinch a little bit with some of the guys to make sure they can keep everybody. But what do you make of the way that they do business? Is that something that is a little controversial or is it, you know, hey, Niner gang, stand up?
No, it's definitely controversial. And I do want to give them credit because the last couple seasons, they've tried to nip these contract extensions in the bud pretty early into free agency, into the new league year. You look at last season, right? The big talking point was what? Brock Purdy. What do you pay him? Mm-hmm. Is he elite? Is he a top 10 guy? Is he a top 5 guy? Ultimately, they get the contract done. He's the highest paid player in the history of the 49ers. But you look at the contract details, it's like, oh, okay, you can get out of this contract in a couple of years. It's not going to hamstring anyone. You know, so they do that. They get George Kittle extended. They get Fred Warner extended. You know, even Trent Williams this offseason, we were expecting that to bleed all the way into training camp, just going off what Trent Williams has done in the past. You know, Debo, Ayuk, et cetera. But they've been pretty good the last few seasons of trying to steer away from the drama. This Ayuk thing outside of the substation, the electrical substation, I'm sure everyone knows about. Outside of that, that's really been the only kind of drama piece. So from a Niner fan's perspective, they're looking at us like, man, we've been really good at steering clear from drama. Maybe we just want to cut ties with Ayuk so we just don't have to see it in the media. But from the Niners organizational perspective, they don't really give a damn about the Ayuk, and I don't think it's affecting them on the field, as we saw last year, them get to the divisional round with basically half a team, given all the injuries.
Talking with Joe Spadoni of the Morning Roast, 95.7 The Game in San Francisco. Just a couple more for you. Last one on Ayuk. When and how does this thing end?
Boy, it's a great question. I do think they end up cutting him now, whether it's, you know, closer to training camp, whether it's sometime this summer, I have no idea. I know a lot of people are saying, hey, the Niners, they can just, you know, hang steady, hang tight, do whatever they want. I do wish there's a, you know, a little demon devil on my shoulder, whatever it is, saying, man, Ayuk, I'd really like it if you showed up to training camp day one and just try to like play, try to like just force Kyle Shanahan's hand in a bit. And again, maybe that's the demon slash, you know, sports talk radio host in me that wants some drama. Of course. Right. But yeah, I see him getting cut eventually. It's not like right at the start of the season. When other roster spots start opening up around the league, there's just no way he's going to get traded. None, absolutely none. There's like no one's touching that contract with a 10-foot pole, especially a guy that didn't play last year, already a year removed from shredding his knee. We don't even know if this guy can play football again. It was that bad of an injury. So I think he gets cut eventually. It'll be this year.
Last thing. I think if you would have told me that June 8th, the Nationals would be out in San Francisco, and one team would be one of the worst teams in the National League, and one team would be 500. I'd be like, oh, maybe the Giants are competing for a playoff spot. And it's the flip side. What the heck has happened to the Giants this year?
It's a great question. So they got into the season, obviously, with a lot of expectations. They made the splashy hire of Tony Vitello, who made the direct jump from college to the pros with no professional experience, obviously winning a national championship with the Tennessee Volunteers once upon a time. And Buster Posey, he's only, you know, second season into this gig, Toby, and this is his first time being a president of baseball operations. No experience, no front office experience, no scouting experience. This guy basically was a consultant for a season, and then he just makes the big jump to being the president of baseball operations. Yeah, he has Zach Manassian as his general manager, who has a long time scouting history, decades plus with the Brewers, et cetera. His brother's the GM over in Los Angeles with the Angels. But outside of that, it's a very unproven front office, right? They make the splashy trade last year for Rafi Devers. They give up on Kyle Harrison, who, by the way, is a baller this year with the Milwaukee Brewers. And they give up on James Tibbs, their high draft pick, who's now one of the top draft picks, draft guys with the Los Angeles Dodgers organization. And then Matt Chapman and Willie Adames, they signed to $150 million-plus contracts. And those guys really haven't produced to the start of the season like they wanted. They dug themselves a big hole. The pitching staff got hurt. Logan Webb, who's on the bump tonight, was out for a while. And they just didn't address the bullpen at all, knowing they were going to be without their all-star from last year, Randy Rodriguez, who had Tommy John. You know, they didn't address the closing role. And that was a big bugaboo this offseason. It's like, man, we're handing this brand new manager who's never managed in the big leagues no bullpen help at all. So that tells you all you need to know about why this team is 12 games under 500. Although, national fans don't want to hear this, you are catching the Giants at a bad time because they have won four out of their last five and looked pretty freaking good against the Brewers towards the end there in the Chicago Cubs.
Nationals fans are just enjoying this magic carpet ride where somehow this team has scored more runs than the Dodgers. So they're enjoying that. My producer also wanted to mention that he used to play with Bryce Eldridge, so make sure you take care of him out there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a name drop. Okay, look at that. Play with Bryce Eldridge. Well, we're still waiting for Bryce to, you know, play a position because he's just been strictly the DH because they just want to leave Rafi Devers in there. But that was a big topic of conversation. The number one overall prospect in the organization, you know, it started slow, but he's actually looking pretty good and like the guy that they hope he could be, which is basically their version of what Aaron Judge is in New York.
Yeah, it seems like the more he's been in the lineup, the better he's gotten. Have you noticed that as well?
I mean, it's just as simple as that, right? Just play the kid every day. I don't know what the whole. I don't know what the whole. The team, Toby, and I'm sorry, I'm going on a tangent here. Yeah. The team was 14 games under 500 and we can't play our number one prospect in back-to-backs, oh, heaven forbid he plays against a lefty. The guy has no experience against lefties.
Yeah.
How is he supposed to get better?
Right.
This is the thing that was just driving Giants fans nuts this entire season. But it looks like it took them to get 14 games under for them to finally see the daylight of, oh, I guess we'll just play the kid every day.
You know, go figure. You just play the kid and he gets a little bit better. Joe, appreciate the time and thanks for hopping on.
No, appreciate it, Toby. You have a good one, man.
Joe Spadoni of 95.7 The Game Morning Roast out in San Francisco. Great guy. And I love talking San Francisco. I mean, it's funny. I got a buddy who grew up in the Bay Area, lives out here now, works at Georgetown. And they struggle so much, Giants fans. And I can imagine it'd be the same way if we had a legend like Buster Posey in charge. But I don't know that Buster's it, man. I don't know that he fully understands how to be the president of baseball ops or GM or whatever his role is there. I don't know that Buster is the best for that role. So that's a little bit tough for Giants fans to swallow. All right, let's talk a little bit of the Nationals. They got a chance tonight. They're playing at night. Day games are apparently their nemesis. I'm calling them the Vampire Nats, although San Francisco is famous for their garlic fries. So maybe it's going to be a bad thing for the Nationals. Regardless, let's talk a little Nats baseball next here on The Fan. Appreciate Joe Spadoni for joining us from 95.7 The Game Morning Roast out in San Francisco. Toby Altizer with you here for another 25 minutes or so, taking you up until Nationals baseball. They're taking on the Giants out in San Francisco, and it's funny to see how this series is, where the Nationals are the team going in there as the better team, and I don't know that a lot of people would have said, yeah, going into the series, one team is going to be 12 games under 500 and one will be at 500. I don't know that anybody would have chosen San Francisco to be the team that's 12 games under. It's kind of funny to see. Nationals begin a three-game series in San Francisco after taking 2 of 3 in Arizona against the Diamondbacks, lost the last one. And the Nationals somehow, some way, still lead the majors in runs scored. They have 7 more runs than the Dodgers, 8 more runs than the Braves, and then fourth, another kind of shocking name near the top, how about the Pittsburgh Pirates? 4th most runs scored, but the Nationals are still 19 ahead of them. Kind of crazy to see what has happened to this National season and the way that they're able to score runs on a night-in, night-out basis. And the reason I say night-in, night-out basis is because the Nationals are terrible during the day. I don't know what it is, but the Nationals do not hit during the day. And we've had enough of a sample size now that I think we can make an assumption about this. They've played 33 night games, 33 day games. They are 17-16 and 19 night games, 16-17 in day games. So not much of a difference in terms of record. But how about a .225 average during the day, but a .262 average at night? How about a sub-300 on base percentage during the day, .299, .345 at night, .459 slug in the evening, .376 slug during the day. That's an .804 OPS in the evening, .675 OPS during the day. I kind of think that's funny. When you look at what happened in this series that they're coming off of with the Diamondbacks, 14-1 in game one, night game, 6-1 over the Diamondbacks game two of the series, night game, day game by their standards at 3 o'clock, 5-1 loss. And the offense kind of looked not like itself in a lot of ways. Didn't look very good. It's just funny to see how this Nationals team can be at times, but it's a blast to watch them. It's a really fun team to get behind, and we talked about it a little bit earlier. They've got superstars at the top here. Maybe they don't have the depth of some other teams, and they don't have a deep order of guys that you would know, which doesn't really matter when you're still scoring the most runs in the majors. But at the top of their order, leadoff hitter every single time this year has been James Wood. Now up to the four hole and consistently hitting there now is CJ Abrams. That's as good a 1-2 punch as just about anybody in the majors. And that's not even a hyperbole because, you know, I'm a Nationals guy. No. You look around Major League Baseball, even the best lineups in Major League Baseball, and it's not that they're the tops with the top guys, I would say, but when you get towards the top of the league, I don't know, man. James Wood and C.J. Abrams is a pretty good dynamic duo to have near the top of your order. And so to watch them on a night-in, night-out basis is a blast. Those guys have been really good, and to see the improvement up and down the order for guys to be able to consistently put runs across has been really cool. And you've seen the improvement of the pitching staff now getting into June. You're seeing the improvement of this team as a whole, and they're playing better baseball. And in turn, they're at 500 on June 8th. And I don't think anybody would have expected for this team to be remotely close to 500 at this point in the season. And now it's about finding that consistency to be able to do this for longer stretches. Because we've seen in the past, you know, it'd be a little disingenuous to pretend like we haven't seen this team be able to play good baseball into June in the last couple of seasons. But generally, you get to the month of June and the wheels fall off. I don't see that happening with this ball club. So I'm interested to see how they continue to do here as you start to get into the dog days of summer. But this lineup is too good. They score too many runs. And I think they deserve the benefit of the doubt on what they're able to do on offense because they've shown us a long enough track record now. Let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk about that. I think this Nationals team has shown you enough now that, you know, even if they have a dry spell like they did against Miami, they deserve more of the benefit of the doubt because they've been so good. And I think this is a fun team to watch, and I can't wait to see what they do in San Francisco before they come back home to take on the Mariners over the weekend. All right, we'll talk about the Nats and the Giants and get you ready for that and talk about some of the things I just mentioned there before we hand it over to Charlie and Dave for Nats on Deck here on 106.7 The Fan. Final couple minutes of overtime, 106.7 The Fan. Toby Altizer taking you up until Nats baseball. 9:15 Nats on Deck with Charlie and Dave ahead of 9:45 first pitch. Nats and Giants out in San Francisco at Oracle Park. We'll take a quick look at that series in just a couple of moments. But one of the things I wanted to talk about, I saw a baseball guy on a baseball podcast talking about the Nats. And I believe he's a Marlins broadcaster, so he's pretty familiar with this team. But he was talking about, you know, how much more do we have to see from the Nationals for them to get the full respect of being the offense that we've seen them be? How much longer do we have to see that? At what point do you look at them and go, yeah, maybe they are one of the top offenses in the sport. Maybe they are a top five offense in the sport. And if you look at where they're at right now, they're tops in the sport in terms of runs scored. The proof is in the pudding in that sense. They are the top offense in the sport. Now, I don't know that you would necessarily frame it as them being the best offense in the sport in terms of what you look at on a night-in, night-out basis. But at the same point, the results speak for themselves. And I think more so than that, in terms of deciding if they're one of the top five offenses in the sport, I'm not as worried about that. What I do want to point out is a lot of people looked at this Nationals team after what happened with the Marlins. You lose three in a row, 7-3, 7-3, 4-1 over the weekend, or excuse me, early last week before you went out to the Diamondbacks over the weekend. And immediately, people are thinking, well, we knew this team wasn't going to be any good, and now they're starting to come back down to earth. See, we told you, this is the team that we all thought that we would see. See? And you're trying to, like, confirm your priors of thinking that this team wasn't going to be very good. And I just think that you've got to have a longer sample size than a three-game stretch before we start looking at it and saying, oh, they've really come back down to earth. Because they followed it up with a 14-1 and 6-1 win over the Diamondbacks. They followed it up by scoring 20 runs in two games, and then they struggled in the finale, but you took 2 of 3 in Arizona, scoring 21 runs. That's a team that is still one of the best offenses in the sport. That's a team that deserves the benefit of the doubt. We're 66 games in. And so in order for me to start to consider, like, oh, man, the Nationals maybe have run into a wall, or they've really slowed down, or maybe they're not one of the top offenses like they've been most of the year. It's going to take, I would say, at least a week of poor hitting for me to consider that, oh, okay, maybe things have caught up to them or anything of that nature. I think we're getting to the point in the year where there's going to be ups and downs over 162. There's going to be a good series and a bad series here and there. But you've now had 66 games to see that this team consistently puts together a good approach, consistently puts together good at-bats, and drives in runs, doing it in all sorts of different ways. It's too much of a sample size for me to just see a three-game stretch where they struggle against Miami and pretend like, uh-oh, it's over. So I think for the rest of the season, or at least until maybe you see a longer stretch if you do this season where there is a struggle, I don't think you have to worry about, oh, man, they've been caught on to and it's really caught up to them and now they've lost it. That stretch has to be a week, week and a half, because when you look at how far ahead they are in terms of runs scored, they can have a bad week and still be one of the top offenses in the sport. You know, if you're just going down to the Orioles, who would fall into just out around the bottom of the top 10, the Nationals are 43 runs ahead of them going into tonight. 43 runs. So even if they have a rough week where they only average 2 runs a game, Orioles probably aren't catching them unless they have an incredible week. So that's something to me that they've garnered enough that they get the benefit of the doubt for quite some time because of the way that they're playing. And that's a massive credit to this staff. Massive credit to this staff, the way that they've been able to get guys to buy in. I think a hallmark of a team that is bought in, a team that cares, a team that's trying to get the most out of every single at-bat, I think a hallmark of those teams is in massive, you've got blowouts or you've got a big lead or you're down big. You don't give away at-bats. You don't give away an at-bat because it still counts against your record. It still counts against your batting average. It still counts for what your stats are on the season. You don't give away at-bats. And this team, to me, has not given away at-bats most of the season. You look back to that Miami series, that's a blip on the radar. Not good at-bats for the most part. Striking out. Not getting runners over. Not coming up big when runners are in scoring position. All those things. That's something that was just a blip on the radar, in my opinion. It's something that now you've had enough of a sample size to see that this team truly is a really good offense. Will it stay this way the rest of the year? Maybe not. Maybe the Dodgers and that NL All-Star team of a lineup eventually passes them. And that's fine, obviously. It's something that no one really expected. But I think it's a massive credit to this team to be able to be where they're at. All right, getting set for a three-game series in San Francisco. We'll turn it over to Charlie and Dave in just a couple of minutes. But looking at this series for the Nats, they're going to face the best arms for San Francisco. And as you heard Joe mention in our interview about half hour ago, they're playing a little bit better of baseball. I'm still not all that worried about a San Francisco team that's been one of the worst in the sport, but Logan Webb going to go tonight for San Francisco. Adrian Hauser going in game 2. Robbie Ray in game 3 of the series. That's two of their three top arms or so. You know, Logan Webb's had a bit of an up-and-down season. Robbie Ray hasn't been at his best, but that's a former Cy Young winner in Robbie Ray, and Logan Webb was one of the top guys in the sport last season. So we'll see how the Nationals fare against them. For the Nats, Michaelis set to pitch most of the game tonight. Lovelady going to open the game for the Nationals. Andrew Alvarez will get a start for the Nationals tomorrow. Foster Griffin set to start the finale. And I'm excited to see what the Nationals are able to do in San Francisco. It could be a really good road trip for them. You took 2 of 3 from Arizona after everybody was starting to feel down after the Miami series. I was curious to see how they would do in Arizona, to see them be able to come out and win that series. Now this is a series where you can put some hay in the barn against a San Francisco Giants team that struggles to score runs. And this is a Nats pitching staff that has been better lately. If you're able to hold them down, score a couple of runs, this will be a fun series at Oracle Park. And it's always fun to see games in this ballpark. Curious to see if anybody could get one in Triples Alley and get to running. I'd love to see Dalen Lyle hit one into that alley and get to motoring around the bags. He's always fun to watch when he gets moving. But, and I'm excited to see how this thing plays out. And It's also cool to see that the All-Star game voting's getting underway and to see a couple of Nationals getting really featured with that, with C.J. Abrams, with James Wood. They've been really, really good. So just a quick reminder as we wrap up here that you can vote 5 times a day, and James Wood, C.J. Abrams, I think they both should be starters for the National League in the All-Star game in Philadelphia. I think it'd be cool to see them, obviously, in Philadelphia. Second All-Star game for James Wood and C.J. Abrams. Excited to see what they're able to do the rest of the way. And it's been a blast to watch this team. And so it's going to be fun to watch them in San Francisco. Late night Nats. I love it. I know not everybody does, but I love it. All right, that's going to do it for us tonight. Appreciate Wes and PJ doing all the hard work behind the scenes. For them, I'm Toby Altizer saying thank you for listening. Nats and Giants coming up next. Charlie and Dave have you the rest of the way. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening.